Welcome again. Now we are having our last speaker, Steve Barker from the University of Nottingham. He's going to talk about global expressivism and truth bearers, a plea for proto acts. So whenever you want, Steve, you have 45 minutes.
Cool. Thank you, everyone, and the organizers for including me in this conference. It's very interesting. So what am I going to do? I'm going to talk about the framework to understand truth bearers. And I'm going to use this concept of a proto act to explain them. But first off, I want to say where I am in terms of the dialectical situation. So what are the truth act sentences, let's say, if we restrict ourselves to that question? And if Regaian tells us that they are, you know, that they are sentences encoding forceless propositions, content, states of affairs, et cetera. Something separate to this thing that they call force. And I don't like that view. I think lots of people don't like that view. Why? Well, all sorts of reasons, but I don't think there's any tenable concept of what encoding or expressing in whatever sense a proposition or a content or the state of affairs is that's gonna do the job. So don't like that view. Everyone's talking about the Spinoza's theory or Hanksian style theory, or maybe it's Recanatian, et cetera, Schmittian, and so forth. Lots of views, others call it the Spinoza's theory. This is that the truth bearers are assertions. So assertions are the one and only truth acts. Why do people believe this? I can see why you don't like the old Fregean theory. Why do you want to go for this view? I'm not clear why ultimately people want to do it. I can kind of get it. But here's the argument which Peter Hanks put forward, and I think he's done this in various places. It's this: well, premise, to be true or false, is to take a stand. Stand takings are assertions. Truth bearers are assertions. That's the argument. Okay, I don't like this argument. When I say I don't like it, I'm not just going to say things a bit bluntly in that way. Why? Well, I don't see why we should accept premise one. Is truth, this is the issue, a success condition? I don't think it is. I think it's a condition on the success of an assertion, let's say, but it isn't itself a success condition. It's not the property of correctly committing oneself to how things are, for example. I don't think it's that property. So this Hanksian argument presupposes the truth is a certain kind of property. I don't think we've got evidence the truth is that property. The T schema and the truth-making schemas, for example, don't imply this view, and I see no reason to accept it. In fact, it causes all sorts of problems if you accept it. What's the problem? Well, it requires that you think that the truth act things are assertions, and that sort of is problematic for reasons that people discuss, which is lots of cases of truth act sentences don't appear to be asserted. Now, people try and bring in some sort of machinery to explain that in terms of cancellation, et cetera, et cetera. I find it obscure, I have to say. I don't quite get what's going on here. Maybe I'll see the light at some point, don't know. But I do think it's, at the very least, kind of problematic and not totally clear what's going on with this idea of cancellation. I'll leave it at that. So what view do I like, and what do I want to talk about? Well, it's this idea that uses the concept of proto-assertion, which I'm going to spend some time defining. And I'm going to, as it were, define truth at sentences through this concept of proto-assertion. It's not assertion, and it's not merely uttering a sentence and coding a proposition, as in the Fregean view. So this is what I'm going to sort of set out. It's that proto-acts, there's a broader class of things called proto-acts, and they're fundamental speech acts. In fact, so all speech is made up of all these things called proto-acts. They're going on all the time. They enable us to communicate. And in fact, proto-acts are more even general to communication in general, not just behavioral proto-acts, for example. Verbal, non-verbal, that's a view I've sort of set out in famously obscure writings. Okay, but no need to go into that. But I'm going to articulate this view. So here are some of the theses. The declarative mood. What is this mysterious declarative mood? Well, it's the mark of proto-assertion. Other moods indicate other kinds of proto-act, like imperative indicates proto-ordering, etc. All declarative sentences are proto-act, proto-asserted, embedded sentences, suppositions, merely entertained, etc., etc. Here's a key idea. Proto-assertion is conceptually dependent on sort of the core aspect of assertion, or I would say the core judgment aspect of assertion. But assertion is conceptually dependent on other aspects of proto-assertion for its, as it were, for communicative possibility. So the dependency goes in both ways, but in slightly different paths. And that's why proto-assertion isn't just this bloodless idea of encoding a proposition, et cetera, but it's not an assertion either. We need, and this is the next point, we need global expressivism to explicate this idea of proto-assertion and of assertion. That's the claim. What do I mean by this? Global expressivism. Well, I'm gonna talk about that. Hopefully without too much sort of ad nauseum detail, just a simple flavor of this idea of global expressivism. So I'm gonna set out this idea, global expressivist framework for understanding language, very sketchy. I'm gonna use it to explain the assertion, non-assertion distinction. I'm gonna do a bit of meaning expressivism along the way. I'm going to talk about communication in terms of proto-acts. And that's going to involve, when I talk about communication, mainly about chimps, it's going to involve this idea of cancellation of default interpretation, which is echoes in some ways, let's say, Hanksian ideas of cancellation. But it's not the same concept, as we'll see. And I'm going to talk about play context and pretense, and then I'm going to define truth and aptness in the end without sense force distinctions. Okay, so here's the slightly maybe bracing part of the paper, but well, can't do anything else. What's global expressivism? Well, it's a bottom-up program. It's really about structures of behavior, etc. It's a generalization of ethical expressivism. Don't know if you know what that means, but that's like this idea that when you utter moral claims, you're expressing, in some sense, motivational or affective states. It's a generalization of that idea, not the idea that all utterances express motivational states. It's a different way of generalizing the concept of ethical expressivism. And it's a meta-semantics. It's not semantics as such. In fact, I'm a bit skeptical about semantics, but we'll see what that means. Okay, so here's some basic ideas. I'm just going to run through it. So it's a form of meta-semantics, generalizing ethical expressivism. It's a theory of production and reception of speech acts, so agents sort of interacting with each other. And it's expressivism about meaning claims, and about norms, and about correctness, and about truth, et cetera. And it takes the line that all elocutionary acts involve productions of sentences expressing, call them mental states. I call them pie states for want of a better word, because we have to go beyond folk psychological concepts to get the theory up and running. So I use somewhat bland terminology, but there it is, which come in a network. So each language agent has a network of these things called pie states, which interact with the world. And they are pre-truth apt, pre-cognitive, pre-representational. So in other words, representational states, things like belief states, et cetera, don't do explanatory work in the mechanisms of the theory. They come in later. We can talk about beliefs and truth apt things, et cetera, later. But they're not part of the bread and butter of the mechanisms through which we explain language operations. that's the sort of expressivist, the generalization of the expressivist idea. So expressivists in ethics kind of want to say, oh, in value statements, we express these non-cognitive states, they say. Okay, they call them motivational, fine. My proposal is, yeah, we do that for everything. The non-cognitive states are always being expressed. That doesn't mean that there are no cognitive states. This means we explain, as it were, concepts of cognitive state later on. In fact, we explain those expressively. Okay, here's I've put up a few little pictures to get the basic idea. So here we go. And I bring in the idea of mirror neurons every now and then from a paper, I've forgotten the reference, from about 20 years ago, maybe. So here we got two agents, and they're producing behavior. One produces sentence, S and R. By the way, can you see the little cursor moving around? No one can reply. Okay. So you've got language production systems on this side, on the left side, and you've got language processing systems on the other side, which are, and their inputs are word patterns, etc. And they activate, those systems activate, as it were, state schemas, a bit like mirror neurons. When you've got one monkey or one chimp looking at another eating banana, in perceiving the other monkey eating banana, the perceiving monkey, as it were, there's inside that monkey, there's an activation of the kind of schemas that go on when, causally speaking, when the monkey is actually eating a banana. So I think something like that is endemic to what's going on in production speech and processing speech. How do you understand what I'm saying at the moment? I just mean the English. The answer is it's a sub-doxastic, sub-personal capacity that's happening. It's utterly automatic. In fact, you can't stop it happening. This is the language processing system in operation. We can only empirically speculate about how it works, but we know roughly that it involves word patterns, et cetera, as input, behavioral background, et cetera, conditions, and it generates some internal output. My sort of core claim is, well, it's not really controversial, what you're expressing when you say, oh, that person means something, is the output of that system. Expressing here means something like manifesting, causally manifesting. So, and this solves a basic problem, that system solves a basic problem about communication, which is we can't look into each other's heads, right? Their cognitive systems are like effectively noumenons in a sort of quasi-Kantian sense. They're beyond the phenomenal world. We can't, as it were, perceive those things. So how do we break out of our internal noumenons? And the answer is we've got these language processing systems, and that's both for production and reception. Okay, so we're just building on this sort of idea in setting up global expressivism. Now, global expressivism is totally programmatic. It's like essentially a proposal of what sorts of questions and frameworks should guide what is ultimately going to be empirical research. Not sitting in your armchair doing this, but you can sort of work out some of the philosophical issues about such a program. Okay, so this is a more detailed little sort of picture. I find these helpful, I don't know. What's going on? Well, you express aspects in speech acts, aspects, individual agent, pi state networks. So each agent, so the left one there and the right one here, U and H, they carry around their great networks. What are these networks? Well, they involve all these things called pi states, let's say. They're in these network relations. What are these network relations? Well, they're the pre-truth act, pre-representational causal patternings that we express when we say one thing is the reason for another thing, for example. So in other words, we express aspects of these networks when we make claims about reason. The speaker has a language production system, an LP system, and an LPE, language processing, sorry, a language processing expression system and a language a production system. And that's how you, as it were, get to S, and that's how you get to interpretation. And these things, the networks are interacting with the world, there's the world down there. And they do through pathways that are like what underlies perception, underlies motivation or affect, underlies what we do when we manipulate things. These are interactions with the world, which in the end feed through to schemata of various kind and generate pi states. You might go, is that pi state network a belief box or something like that? And I go, it's not useful to talk about belief at this level. It's not useful even to talk about representation at this level in the final story. Empirically, what's the structure of it? Well, we need science to tell us. So there it is. Okay, so what distinguishes assertions from other illocutionary acts? Well, assertions involve acts whose purpose is to defensively express the speaker's pi states. So all other illocutionary acts involve production of sentences merely expressing speaker pi states, but they're not defending these. So what I want to do is explain this idea of defending. What is this defending idea? It's being disposed to manifest structures underpinning reasons, essentially. That's a slightly Brandonian version of it. At a folk psychological level, you could sort of say that's an approximation. You could say it's a speech act of assertion is the act whose purpose is to manifest a dialectical stance in relation to a mental state. Okay, something along those lines. Again, folksy, intentional idiom, etc. What I want to say is underlying these folksy ideas, and it's also tied up with the idea that assertion is somehow knowledge manifesting, et cetera, et cetera. It's this act directed towards manifesting aspects of the pi state network surrounding one pi state pi of the speaker. Ooh, what does that mean? Well, picture helps, maybe. So here's the speaker, there's their sort of pi state network. They're the inputs, the let's say perception back there, affect, et cetera, et cetera. There's this ordered structure to it, would exhibit all sorts of compositionality features, et cetera. Someone says, Steve ought to leave. What are they doing? Well, they're defensively expressing this state at the tip, gamma. Okay, that gamma, that pi state is connected with this network. What's the point of assertion? Here's the thought. It's the need of speakers to manifest the architecture that they carry around with them, which enable them to navigate the physical environment and the social environment. And human beings at some point invented a kind of speech act or expressive act to do this. And so what we have manifested here is this. So Steve ought to leave, you're expressing that kind of state, and you're disposed to manifest the architecture. And that means you might do it verbally, but you might do it through pointing, et cetera. You might go, oh, Steve was rude, right? So that's going to be expressing a gamma two, which is connected in this tree of pi states. And then you might say further, blowing raspberries is rude, and that's going to express this other state, and so on, rudeness is bad, et cetera, et cetera. That is all manifesting aspects of the architecture. That's what, in other words, you're expressively or defensively expressing a pi state. That's pretty abstract, pretty kind of non-folk psychological description, but I'm saying in the end, we have to bring in structures that beyond, as it were, the folk psychological, and that's what expressivism is doing. So we have things like this, just illustrating that. So Steve ought to leave, true. So you're defensively expressing, in this sense, some pi state delta, let's say, linked to motivational. I said gamma in the other drawing, but don't worry. It's linked to a motivational or ura motivational state. And the person on the other side processes that, sort of activates states or schemas in their own case, and then, as it were, discovers, well, they don't discover, they have the corresponding pi state in a network. And they go, true, because they too are disposed to, in their own case, defend the homologous pi state. That's the sort of idea. I've got a few things here about dialectical preparedness and so forth. Here's a contrast. If I'd give an order, may have very similar motive, pi state involved, may have the same pro attitude to an action or action scheme or to the pi state that would be deployed in stating what this action is. So, as it were, both assertions of the form Steve ought to leave and remove Steve or Steve leave involve same underlying pi states which are linked to motivation. But what's the difference? Well, in this one, you're defending it, whereas in this one, you're merely expressing it. And that's the difference between what we call an assertion and an order. Assertions are very democratic things. They involve, as it were, in effect, inviting others to reject, as it were, your stance. In other words, and that's what you're doing when you are manifesting a defensive disposition. Whereas orders are just autocratic in this sense. They're just expressing the pi state, in this case, one linked to motivation, and the audience, as it were, insofar as there's an authority structure involved, as indicated there, they, as it were, just assimilate the state in their own case, or rather what they process to be that state through their language processing system. And then they develop the motivation if they follow the order, which is they literally have the attitude to remove Steve, to put it in slightly mixed theoretical and folk psychological terms. Okay. That's sort of clear, but not all assertions are about have motivational states involved. They can also have states like in causal statements, like what characterizes our concept of causation? Well, in the end, it's the fact that we go around manipulating things when we're babies. So when you're a baby, you bang things and smash things and so on. You're grasping, in the end, causal concepts through manipulating things in the world. So that's the nature of causal assertion. So when I say this caused the break, what I'm doing is defensively expressing a pi state linked to agent manipulative capacities. And then your audience, as it were, responds to that, and so forth. So bold hypothesis about illocutionary acts and mental states. It's very simple. Here's the idea. There's the truth act. Speech acts and call them mental states, and they're the non-truth fact. So here's the claim. Judgment, assertion, and belief are all on one level. They're all explicated in terms of defensively expressing pi states. So judgment is more or less utterance of an internal sentence, let's say, defensively expressing a pi state, even if just to yourself. Assertion is the public production of that. Belief is a disposition to do that. Or it ultimately has that as its engine or core, a disposition to defensively express. You don't find beliefs down at the level of pi states. That's the pre-truth act, pre-cognitive. You don't even find desires there, technically speaking. You find affective states. On the right-hand side, we have orders, optatives, implicatures, wishes, et cetera, et cetera. What are they doing? They're involved in mere expressing. They're not raising things, as it were, to mixed levels, to the dialectical level. Okay, so assertions are appropriate objects of truth ascriptions, whereas orders, optatives, performatives, questions are not. And orders are restricted to attitudes. I say proto-attitudes, that's mixing the term a bit. That's why they're more restricted, orders. Peter Hanks was talking about that question of restrictedness, limitedness. But that's my take on what it is. All the variety in the different kinds of non-truth app speech acts comes with the different kinds, different structures in the kinds of pi states and their interactions with the world involved in each case. Okay, first part over. I think I got about 17, 18 minutes. Second part. Communication. How do we communicate? We can't look inside each other's heads. And there are no meanings in heads anyway. So even if we were to look, we'd just see bunches of neurons and tissues and structures, etc. How do we do it? Well, we do it through our language and behavior processing systems, but how do they, those systems sort of do the job? And I want to say, or put forward this, again, bold proposal, is they do through proto-acts. So audiences process proto-acts, then seek cancellation markers for behavior. This is where the issue of cancellation comes in, but I've got a very different take on it compared with, let's say, what Peter Hanks is proposing. Because I don't think assertions are the fundamental truth bearers. So here we go, big and little. Big is baring his teeth. Little is kind of looking a bit confused. Little is kind of saying, hey, is that, this guy want to beat me up? Or is that kind of just playing around? Right, that's the sort of communicative problem for little. But little can't look in big's head. So how does little deal with that problem? Well, it's through, sorry, my spelling not very good here, proto-acts and repertoire dispositions. This is, I'm going to tell this little story. It's obviously slightly simplistic, but it's a kind of hypothesis, fairly clear, basic elements. You know what you're dealing with. Okay, when chimps get angry, they can bare their teeth. So they have a repertoire dispositional schema, which, you know, you can see this across the board with chimps. It's like this. Angry can lead to baring teeth. Not invariably. You could do other things, I suppose. But that schema is there as a general dispositional tendency or action schema. And that's sort of built into the hardware of their systems, or they acquire it at some point. When they bare their teeth, often their action is guided by this dispositional schema, this repertoire disposition. That is, angry and baring teeth is a causal factor in producing baring teeth. This causal episode can occur because, in fact, the chimp is angry. And this anger has triggered manifestation of the repertoire disposition, in which case you've got state, angry, and you got the repertoire disposition, angry can lead to baring teeth. And this, they together cause baring teeth. Right? That's what happens when there's manifestation. But there's also guidance because the baring teeth is only happening in part because of the, they've got this repertoire disposition. But sometimes you get just the first path of causation, that is the guiding aspect, but without the manifesting. So in other words, you get, there's no anger, but there's a baring of teeth happening. And this has been caused in part by this repertoire disposition schema. That's a causal factor in why this is happening, right? But there's no anger, right? So in other words, you go offline, as it were, in that sense. It's not a manifestation because of there's an angry state. It's rather, and this is a sophisticated thing animals start doing at some point, right? The repertoire disposition is autonomous from manifestation. It's just doing a job causing behavior, right? So let's go back to Little's predicament. Big bares his teeth to Little. Is Big, what's the actual, so there is in fact a causal, definitely a causal path going on in Big, which is angry, the repertoire disposition leading to baring of teeth. So, and because he's a good behavioral processor, Little, mirror neurons, remember, Little's B processing, behavioral processing system, activates an action schema. Angry, baring teeth, baring teeth. So in other words, that's their sort of activation, which underlies their perception of what Big is doing. But Little has an interpretive problem. And this is how Little would do it if he was a sort of cognitive scientist who could introspect, et cetera, et cetera. But he can't. But so we're anthropomorphizing with him. Big angry or is Big playing? In other words, is this pure guidance? Is this just behavior produced by the repertoire disposition, but there's no manifestation? Or is there manifestation? Scenario one, Big just stares menacingly, so with the baring of the teeth. Little's behavior processing system activates angry, definitely know this is happening, or sorry, the homologous state. Angry, so blue means activated in Little's head, as it were. Angry, fixed state, that's guiding fixed state, fixed stare behavior, right? Okay, so in other words, Little has activated angry, baring teeth, producing baring teeth, and angry can produce fixed stare, it's causing fixed stare. So it's confirmation for Little of manifestation, because it's got two, as it were, proto-acts. Well, they're called proto-acts, but two activations of a repertoire dispositions producing behavior. So Little system derives pi state, phi angry. That is, it's his little token that in the end is how underlies his conceptualization of Big. Phi angry, that generates a pi state linked to motivation, and Little runs away. Whoa. Scenario two, cancellation behavior, Big winks and coos. So in other words, does the baring of teeth, but winks and coos. So Little's B process system activates action schemas. all the following, this in blue gets activated. And what's interesting about this case is in Little, the antecedents, angry, happy, happy, in the repertoire dispositions are in conflict. That is, activation states, I suppose, is another way of putting it, would normally causally exclude each other. So phi happy, so as it were, Little has to make a decision which one, or if any, is operative. So given that conflict and the preponderance of the happy ones, Little plumps for, phi happy outweighs phi angry. So Little systems does not activate phi angry. That interpretation is canceled. So in other words, in working back from the effects to the causes, as it were, given the set of behaviors that Little is presented with, her system activates phi happy and doesn't activate phi angry. And that means, as it were, the serious intent of the teeth bearing act has been canceled. So there's a proto act there, but the serious intent manifestation that could accompany it has been canceled. And then at that point, Big and Little can play together and there's playing. You could define playing, I won't do it, I'll just zoom on. So speech act communication is just like this, bold hypothesis. It involves proto-acts and cancellation. So production of external and internal speech works through repertoire dispositions from in the case of assertion, from expressive dispositions to production words. So we have there on the left, D, F, pi, arrow, S, etc. That's a summing up this repertoire disposition, which is if you system is disposed to defensively express pi with a sentence, she may produce S as a result of that disposition. That's as part of her repertoire. And these are individual dispositions of speakers, but conspecifics for languages massively share structural homologous, that's a word, repertoire disposition systems. In fact, my assertion, that's English, when I'm listening to some people speaking, involves me defensively expressing a pi state rooted in activation of my repertoire dispositions, as it were, that underlie my ability to speak English. Okay, we can now define proto-assertion. A repertoire disposition, there it is, def pi arrow to S, can cause production of S in two ways. One, simply by being a factor that constrains selection of S, or by being dispositionally triggered by the disposition to defensively express a state, leading to the production of S, manifesting. So in other words, you've got guiding and manifesting. Okay, both, so that's one and two. That's one is guiding, just selection of S, guided by that repertoire disposition, and two is actually being manifested. You've actually got the defensive state, impulse to defend. Both are present in assertion. But sometimes there's just the first way, one, the guiding way. So sincere assertion involves in you, you've got the defensive disposition, there it is, def pi, you've got the repertoire disposition, and they together cause production of S, ways one and two combine. And there's no cancellation behavior. So in other words, not doing something funny, like winking when you produce the sentence, the world is going to end in 10 minutes, right? You don't, whatever. Any other, as it were, cancelling behavior in the way that Big, the chimpanzee Big, engaged in cancelling behavior when Big winked. What we call just a pure proto-assertion of S comprises production of S caused in at least one way, and that way is just one, that is guidance. So you find that in assertion. So in assertion, as it were, what's behind production of S involves, as it were, the repertoire disposition, just guiding selection of S, et cetera. But you also have the dispositional state. But you can lack that dispositional state, but still have the utterance guided by the repertoire dispositions. Okay, that's what you got with a non-asserted. Well, let's say something like an embedding. I'll talk about that in a second. So running out of time a bit here. So we can set that up in terms of this mirror neuron story. In these. So when I say that someone means something by a sentence, what I'm expressing is activation of a repertoire disposition in me, there on the right, schema, def, gamma, generates, can generate S, that's causing S, just that's being activated. And I go, oh, you mean, you're meaning that snow is white, or you're meaning whatever it is. I'm just expressing that activation state when I, involving the repertoire disposition. Okay. So you've got full-blown assertion, which is both manifestation and guiding occurring with the repertoire disposition. But you've got, as it were, other cases where it's just the repertoire disposition guiding the production of the sentence. And that's what, this is a, as it were, a pure proto-assertion with cancellation of the default interpretation that you're doing assertion, essentially. And that's what you find in play contexts. So in things like suppose P, if BQ, it's not the case that P overleaves the P and so forth, what's going on there? Well, P and Q are proto-asserted in this simple sense that what's guiding production is just the repertoire disposition. You don't have the disposition to defend the state, or rather, you in fact are signaling lack of that in this convoluted way I've been talking about. You're not asserting. Why would you not, as it were, that's too much cognitive baggage. You're just doing this thinner act, which is common in assertion, but also in these cases as well, which is just utterance guided by the repertoire disposition, where those repertoire dispositions define, as it were, or underlie what we call your competence in the language. And then we can sort of tell this story in terms of taxonomies of speech acts. As I suggested or said before, proto-assertion is what you always do with a declarative sentence, right? That's kind of the defining speech act of a declarative sentence. That's what mood indicates. So you've got sincere assertion, insincere assertion, embedding, and fiction. So here's my, I'm estimating I've got another 8 minutes to talk. What's sincere assertion? Well, no pretense. You've got a proto act, you've got defensively expressing. Pi, you've got no cancellation of default interpretation. You're not winking or doing something funny. insincere assertion, that involves pretense. You've got a proto act, but you lack the defensive orientation. So you just got the pure guidance aspect of the causation, just producing S as being, as the repertoire disposition behind it. You lack the defensive state, but you've got no cancellation of default. So in other words, you're looking serious, et cetera, et cetera. So the chimp, as it were, being looking at you, goes for the default interpretation, which is you're manifesting. That's insincere assertion, but it's assertion. And you've got embedding. Here you just got, as it were, guidance happening. I don't think that's pretense. So some people go, oh, that's pretense. So embedding involves no pretense. You as proto-acting, proto-asserting, but it's not a pretending to do something or be something they are not. It's just cancellation of the default interpretation. Fiction, however, when you got someone saying something in a stage play, you got cancellation in my thin sense, but you've also got pretending happening. And pretending is a more complex thing that I set out here, which, if there is a question time, we could go on about. Okay, so here's the core idea. Patterns of truth happiness. I'm going to do this in about 4 minutes. Sincere, insincere assertions, truth apt. Embedded declarative sentences can be truth apt. Sorry, this is just a phenomena I take to be the case. Fictional utterances, say an actor saying our fears in Banquo stick deep. It's not truth apt. what about performed as indirect speech acts and irony? Okay, I can use proto-acts. This is what happens in performatives. I use a proto-act, I proto-assert, I hereby name this ship Pinafore, but I've cancelled and I'm doing something, using that proto-act to do something non-assertoric, in effect. I proto-act when I say proto-assert, but not assert, I proto-assert. You will be on that train tomorrow at 6 a.m., but cancellation, doing something else, expressing an ur attitude. And Boris's visionary, okay, theatrical thing, still proto-acting, but playing around. None of these are truth act. What then is? So proto-assertions in irony, fiction, performatives, indirect speech acts, etc., proto-assertions layered in further non-defensively expressive interpretations. That's why they're not truth act. A truth act sentence is a proto-assertion lacking any further non-defensive expressive goal, lacking these further interpretive clothing, you might say. And you could say, summed up, a truth act sentence is a proto-asserted one, that is an assertion-ready proto-assertion. It's ready to go to put into assertion. There's no further layering of interpretations on it, as you find in, let's say, performatives, which are not truther. And what is truth? Like, I began with the question, well, what is this truth? Is truth itself a success condition of representing rightly or something like that? Which I think Peter Hanks is assuming in his argument. No. I'm not into defining truth. In fact, I don't like analysis generally. I'm into giving an expressivist analysis of what goes on when you say S is true. And what you're doing is, when you say S is true, is you're defensively expressing a pi state, sigma, whose canonical cause is a disposition to use an assertion-ready proto-assertion in a self-standing act of assertion. So unasserted proto-acts, perfectly true that. Mood is the perfect indicator of the proto-act that you're performing. So imperative mood indicates proto-water. This is universal, no exceptions. Imperative mood indicates interrogative, confusion. Indicative or declarative mood indicates proto-assertion. But what you do with that proto-assertion, it's flexible, you can play around with it. It's not an assertion. So you don't have to somehow, it doesn't have assertoric commitment in it. You're not intending to represent how the world is, et cetera, et cetera. It's just this act produced by the repertoire disposition. And when we say that means something, what we're doing is expressing the fact that we process that act in terms of the repertoire disposition in our own case. Okay, so overall, final slide, penultimate slide, actually. There is no false content distinction in reality. I think that's really part of the metaphysics of meaning. In fact, I'm inclined to think that semantics is, to some degree, kind of mode of metaphysics about the nature of. There's no noistic, tropic, thoracic, etc. distinction. There's a neutral act, proto-assertion in all contexts, indicated by mood. Proto-acts are not pretense acts, but neutral acts. In a longer version of this paper, I'll talk about François Repentigny's version of the sort of play as going through the motions of assertion act. There's interesting things to talk about there, but I can't do that. No false cancellation. Cancellation of default interpretation of proto-assertion as manifesting a defensive disposition. Think of big and little. That's what goes on. That's the only sort of cancellation I would accept. I think that's causally explicable in terms of my sort of baby theory of communication in terms of processing speech. I think that's got some virtue in this framework, but that's it. Anyway, thanks. Vive le proto-act. That's
hi. Steve, hi. Thanks for the talk. That was fascinating. Is there any place in your system for something like Fragean thoughts or contents or propositions? I was looking out for that, and I didn't see that anywhere in your theory. No. There are no such things as contents like.
Good. Great question. So here's my position. Yeah, there are contents. There are meanings. There are assertions, etc., etc. But there's just no theory about what these things are constituted by. There's no, as it were, science of representation. So I believe in representation. And you go, well, what's your explication of representation? And the answer is, I don't analyze it. I don't think you can naturalize it. But I'll give you an expressivist account of what goes on when you say, oh, that represents that. These tree rings represent, the age of the tree, etc. So in other words, instead of giving analysis of what meaning is or what meaning is constituted by, or meaning the same is constituted by, etc., you give expressivist analysis of what goes on when you talk about these things. But I don't think that commits you to any nihilism about meaning or propositions. Propositions in the sense of truth-bearing things, like thoughts, as you suggest.
So there's a way in which you can say there are propositions.
Yeah.
Right? And that's something you can say, and maybe it's true. But you're going to explain what's going on there by giving your expressivist account of what I'm doing when I say there are propositions.
Yeah.
Right? Instead of coming up with a metaphysics of what those things are or something.
That's right.
Okay, that's very helpful.
Perfect.
Yeah, thank you.
Summing up. I'm trying to get myself, I'm trying to see an image of people that I currently lost. Do I stop sharing? Anyway, I'll just fly on instruments. Yes.
Hey, Steve, thanks so much.
Hi.
Two questions for you, neither of which is meant to be very deep, but one of them is, your notion of expression seems pretty broad insofar as I think you glossed it as just a matter of manifestation of an internal, or at least a psychological state. And I guess, at least from an ordinary language point of view, one might want to say that's too broad because, for example, if my anxiety causes me to sweat, then even if that's true, we might hesitate to say that my sweating is an expression of my anxiety. I'm happy with the idea that my sweating is a manifestation of the anxiety, but you might be tempted by the idea that to be an expression, it's got to be somehow more in the game of communication, so that tears might be an expression of sadness because, you know, as a matter of human evolution, it might be the case that they were designed to do a certain job, or scowling's an expression of anger because, you know, here's an empirical claim about the evolutionary etiology of scowling as a facial expression, is that it was designed to telegraph my affective state. So am I right to think that, at least for your purposes, you don't feel any need to fine-grain it in such ways to distinguish between manifestation and expression? I'm not saying you should, as just in a quest for kind of getting a sense of where you're coming from.
Very good question to raise. I think you have to fine grain it. So what's it going to be? Well, I take to be the relevant sense of expressing. It's going to involve these processes involving repertoire dispositions.
Whoops.
Oh, he froze. Hi, Steve, you froze. I don't know if you can hear us.
No.
Okay, I'm going to write to him.
It's like Socrates, mid-thought. Come back a week later.
That might have been...
We lost you. Steve, we lost you for the last, 30 seconds. So maybe you could start your answer again, if that is possible. You froze up. He's frozen again. Dang.
Sorry, it's probably my internet. Sorry. Yeah, can you hear me now?
We lost you a second time.
Oh, God.
Okay, let's try it again and hope for the best.
Okay, I think you have to fine grain it. In other words, the relevant sense of expression is one using the repertoire disposition processes being activated, the production systems to issue in an utterance. Did you get that?
Yeah, I think so.
So in other words, when I go, it's hot now, or the internet is playing up, that's an utterance that's been, as it were, caused through the engagement of repertoire dispositions, etc., and purposeful restriction of canceling behavior, etc.
But, right. Okay, my point is just that seems like a fine graining, but at least I would tend to think that that's a bit revisionary relative to the way we normally use the notion of expression.
Oh, good. Okay.
Which
so
is,
some
again,
people
not an objection. That's just an attempt to get clear on what you're
asking. Cool. Some people say, why do you use the word global expressivism? And I go, okay, drop the word expressivism if you don't like it. Uh-huh. Because there's a folk sense of expressing where I express something, by saying thanks, et cetera, or boo, and so on. Hooray. Yeah, not that sense. So if you want to drop expressing as misleading, I'm happy to do that. I just can't find a better word.
There's no, it's not, it sounds pretty clunky to say global manifestationism.
Exactly.
That might be others too. Yeah. So my other question is about this. You had maybe the fourth or fifth from last slide, you had a box that had, things like assertions, and a box that had embedded cases and so forth. And you gave a sort of gloss of each one. And what I was wondering about is, I can see how you account for assertion, but I'm wondering whether your sort of defensive manifestation approach to assertion is going to allow you to talk about how, for example, asserting a content differs from, for example, conjecturing it.
Oh, good. Yeah, that's a really good question. So that's right. So I have thought about that, and I'm just hoping it's more dealing with detail rather than sort of a, you know, fundamental problem. So you could call full-blown assertionist where you're completely unrestricted in the architecture that you're, as it were, directed to manifest in. But you could have those restricted forms where, in fact, there are sort of, you don't actually have the pi state, but, or it, maybe we've got to talk about some sort of degrees of of entry of the pi state into the network, where there are some, as it were, links that go there, which underlie ultimately your confidence in a kind of claim. For example, you could be conjecture, global, you know, proto acts of the basic acts of communication, some conjecture.
Fair enough, but it seems like, wouldn't you want to also reach for different ways of understanding the notion of defense? So that, I mean, you're leaving defense as sort of an unexplained explainer, at least for these purposes, but I would have thought that, you know, one thing that's true about the difference between asserting and conjecturing is that for the second but not the first, I should be prepared to answer a sort of how do you know question. If I conjecture the P and somebody says, how do you know, my answer was, you don't understand what I'm doing. That doesn't mean that I don't have to give any kind of defense at all. The bar is lower, though. But it seems like you're within your, it seemed to me, this is just kind of a friendly suggestion. You're within your rights to say there are different types, different forms that defense can take, and therefore different types, different forms that I can be prepared to defend a proposition or some kind of act content with, and that's the at least part of the story about how there's a difference between asserting and conjecturing, for example.
Okay, cool. I think one, I don't think defense in the end is an unexplained explainer. I want to say empiric sort of conjecture. You're manifesting architecture. Okay, what's that architecture? Hypothesis. Involves these relationships, which are causal in nature, between these things called pi states, which have, as it were, canonical and non-canonical inputs. You should sort of all try and develop a theory of that, which is not so much philosophical theory, but one in cog-sci, cleansed of representational idioms. And then there's this question of how do we deal with the following thing, which probably relates to what you're saying, which is the context dependence, often people call it, of assertion, right? So degrees of certainty. You know, I could, by shifting the context, I say, oh, someone is, you know, leaving work now, and then you point out something to me, and I go, oh, well, yeah, I don't really know that, or I don't really, can't really assert that. But, so I, so there are different grades of, as you suggest, defense, but I would put that in terms of different grades in which different aspects of the architecture of the network are being expressed. So some are more, as it were, robust. You're going to, as it were, take that defensive stance to the hilt, that is always stick to manifesting the architecture. Others are less robust. I think that robustness might, sort of degrees of robustness, might also be in the case of so-called faultless disagreement, where someone goes, oh, Vegemite is tasty. And then we get into an argument about Vegemite, I don't know what, if you know what that is tasty, and I kind of just sort of give up at some point, we both give up. In other words, we stop defending pi states. We go, well, we can't defend these to the hilt. Mm-hmm. Maybe conjecture falls in a similar camp. It needs finessing, I agree.
Good, thanks very much.
Hi, Steve, thanks for your talk.
Thanks.
Yeah, so I was wondering, following up on what Mitch just asked about the defensively expressing, but in the other direction, and I think we've talked about this before, but I would like to hear again what you think about it. It sounds to me when you talk about defensively expressing and make this contrast between assertions and truth act on the one hand and a non-truth act on the other hand, it sounds as if you're making the kind of claim that Brandom and other people make, and that I just talked with Indrek about it, maybe that's why I'm also now attuned to that, that they say their reasons have to be propositions, so you can only defend assertions because you can only give reasons for assertions. And personally, I'm always somewhat amazed how philosophers so cursorily seems to me dismiss whole swaths of discourse, how we actually talk, because it seems to me we do give all sorts of what I would call practical reasons when you ask for why should we do something or why to do something, why go for a walk, and you might to get some fresh air, this kind of thing. So we justify directives, we justify our purposes with other purposes, just like we justify assertions with other assertions that we make.
Yeah.
So now your slides pop back up, but you can hear me, right? So
yeah, yeah.
And I think you once said that your view is not quite like Brandom's or other people who think there are no practical reasons in that sense, but it would be curious to hear again how you think about this.
Cool. Good. So I kind of agree with you and sort of disagree, kind of. So Brandom. I think Brandom's giving us an approximate folk, refined folk, psychological folk, pragmatic concept of assertion. But it's problematic for the reasons I think we said. Well, I think it's problematic because, as it were, we give reasons for assertions and beliefs. And so what are they doing in Brandom's theory? It seems to be circular in some sense. And I also agree with you, what you said as well. We also give reasons for non-belief states, for desires, etc. I agree with that. So where do I come into this? I say, look, Brandom, I'm not a Brandomian. I think Brandom's giving a sort of folk, pragmatic, psychological approximation to, as it were, what's really going on. What's really going on is when we have to drop idioms of folk psychology, etc., and start postulating structures, as it were. And here's my little drawing of sort of these structures. So we have to go full-blown theoretical, and we have to say, well, look, there are these pi states, and they form a network, and I think you might like this part, some of the canonical causes for these things are perceptual-like states, and others are affect-like states, others are manipulative states, activities, etc. But I don't think you find reasons here. There's no reasons at this level. Reason is what we get at the phenomenal level when we start using symbolic language and we say, oh, you've got a reason for that, or believing this or desiring this is a reason for this. And that's what you're doing there is expressing aspects of this architecture, expressing in my technical kind of sense of expressing. So I'm kind of not signing up to Brandom. I think other people approaching assertion are kind of getting on to the flavor of it. In other words, they have the right intuitions. I'm explaining their intuitions, as it were. So I'm more into explaining intuitions that we have about assertion than explaining assertion. I'm more into explaining folk semantic intuitions than trying to develop that folk semantic concepts into a full-blown semantic theory, in the way that we take folk concepts of motion and force and develop them into a physics. I kind of going to go, no, we're not going to do that for the folk psychology, folk pragmatics, folk semantics, etc. We're going to tell an expressivist theory about why we have the intuitions we have about assertion, etc. And Brandom is an intuitive, sophisticated intuitionist in the sense that he's taking folk psychological concepts and trying to build a theory about the essence of assertion out of these intuitions. But I think it's problematic, and for the reasons just indicated, including the fact that I think desire states can also be reasons for assertions, etc. I hope I'm answering your question.
Thank you. No, it was helpful.
So it seems that
there
are no more questions. So maybe we should thank Stephen again. And I guess that's it, right? Yeah.